idea. Towns and clubs sprang up all over the country, with as many as 5 million members. The idea gradually died out after Roosevelt proposed the Social Security system. Charles E. Coughlin. A Roman Catholic priest, Charles Coughlin was, after Roosevelt himself, the best radio orator in America. Broadcasting from the Shrine of the Little Flower in Royal Oak, Michigan, Coughlin was a super patriot who ripped into Wall Street, big business, and oppressive bosses. Originally, he supported FDR, but soon he became an ardent foe, advocating the nationalization of banks and ripping into Roosevelt as a communist tool of Jewish bankers. Coughlin created the National Union for Social Justice, which drew more than 5 million members in less than 2 months. But his increasingly shrill attacks on Jews and Roosevelt created a backlash, and by mid-1940, the bombastic cleric had quieted down considerably. Despite the fact that their schemes were pretty Looney Tunes, FDR's more vocal and visible critics did put some pressure on him to continue to press for reform, especially during his first term. "I am fighting communism, Huey Longism, Coughlinism, Townsendism," FDR said with some exasperation. "I want to save our system, the capitalist system, but I want to equalize the distribution of wealth." Meanwhile, a guy named Hoover was fighting outlawism. Shirley Temple. She was less than 4 feet tall, and she was the biggest thing in Hollywood. Dancing, singing, and mugging her way into the hearts of a country that really needed someone to hug. Born in 1928 in Santa Monica, California, Shirley Temple made her first movie at the age of 3. She went on to make 24 more during the 1930s and was the number one box office attraction every year from 1935 to 1938. Movies like Little Miss Marker and Captain January earned the curly-headed charmer $300,000 a year. And thousands more were added by royalties from the sales of Shirley dolls, dresses, dishes, soap, and books. Little girls all over the country wanted to look like, sound like, and be adored as much as Shirley. Temple retired from films in the late 1940s and had a brief career on TV. She married oil executive Charles A. Black in 1950 and gradually became active in politics. She served as a U.S. representative to the United Nations, ambassador to Ghana, and chief of protocol for the State Department in the 1970s. She died in February 2014 at the age of 85. Bad Guys and G-Men. While some were coming up with political proposals to redistribute wealth, others had a more pragmatic approach. They stole it. The 1930s saw the rise of the modern outlaw. Instead of 6 guns and horses, they used Tommy guns and Fords. Some of them became folk heroes, robbing banks that many people felt had robbed their customers. There was Charles Pretty Boy Floyd, who reportedly robbed more than 30 banks and killed 10 men before he was gunned down in 1934. There was Arizona Ma Barker, whose gang consisted mainly of her 4 sons and who died in a shootout with the law. There were Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow, a pair of Texas lovers, robbers, murderers, who became folk heroes despite the fact that many of their fellow desperados regarded them as trigger-happy bunglers. And there was John Dillinger. An Indiana native, Dillinger robbed a grocery store in 1924 and was caught. He did 9 years in prison, and when he got out, he started a 14-month crime spree that made him one of the most famous or infamous men in America. Dillinger killed 10 men, engineered 3 daring jailbreaks, escaped from two gun battles with the law and stole as much as $265,000. He also became something of a Robin Hood. Dillinger does not rob poor people, a fan wrote to the newspapers. He robs those who became rich robbing poor people. I am for Johnny. In the end, such popularity did Dillinger little good. Federal agents killed him in 1934 as he left a movie theater in Chicago. Fighting the bad guys were the G-Men, a nickname given to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI agents, by George Machine Gun Kelly. The G stood for government, and the head G-Man was an owlish-looking, fiercely intense man named J. Edgar Hoover. As head of the FBI, Hoover combined a fanatical sense of duty and a flair for public relations to make his agency a beacon for heroism and integrity. Serving as director from 1924 until his death in 1972, Hoover was one of the most powerful figures in 20th century America. His almost pathological hatred of communism, his dictatorial manner, and his unethical and quite probably illegal use of the Bureau against political and personal enemies eventually stained his name. But in the 1930s, millions of American boys wanted to be him. The Panic of a Martian Invasion. Mercury Theater players had a dull story on their hands and a deadline looming for their live Halloween Eve performance on CBS Radio in 1938. But writer Howard Koch did his best with H.G. Wells's novel, The War of the Worlds, bringing the Martian invasion into the 1930s and relocating it from England to New Jersey. And Mercury leader Orson Welles used all his considerable acting talent to make it as realistic as possible. In fact, he and the rest of the cast did too good a job. Despite several announcements that it was just a radio show, many in the show's audience of several million thought there was a real Martian invasion going on. Panic spread, although just how much is a subject of debate among historians. People called police to ask what to do. In New Jersey, families hastily packed and took to the roads. There were several reports of attempted suicides. It took 2 days to calm things down, and criminal charges were even considered against Wells. In the end, however, the show got a big new sponsor, Campbell Soup, and Wells was invited to the White House. "You know, Orson," President Roosevelt told him, "you and I are the two best actors in America." Chapter 16. The World at War, 1941 to 1945. In this chapter, heading toward war, contributing to the war effort, fighting overseas and at sea, using the first atomic bomb. Very few Americans had any use for the dictators of Europe and Asia, but even fewer had a burning desire to fight them. World War I had left a bad taste in the mouths of many, and the lingering effects of the Depression were still being felt. The United States didn't need a foreign headache. But as this chapter shows, sometimes a fight just can't be avoided, particularly when it seems half the world is being run by monsters. Faced with the most widespread and horrific war in human history, Americans respond magnificently. They also develop and unleash a weapon that will forever change the future of mankind. Trying to avoid war again. Despite the hangover from World War I and America's refusal to join the League of Nations, the country didn't exactly become a hermit in the 1920s and 1930s. In 1922, U.S. government and private interests helped feed more than 10 million starving Russians. The country also provided more than $100 million in aid to Turkey, Greece, and other Mediterranean countries in the 1920s and forgave or reduced World War I debts. On the diplomatic front, the United States, Great Britain, Japan, France, and Italy agreed in 1922 to limit their warship building, and in 1928, French Foreign Minister Aristide Briand and U.S. Secretary of State Frank Kellogg convinced themselves and 15 other countries to formally agree not to go to war with each other. As completely unrealistic as the agreement may have been, so eager for peace was the U.S. Senate that it ratified the Kellogg-Briand Pact on an 85-1 vote. Playing the role of a good neighbor. Closer to home, Presidents Harding and Coolidge weren't shy about interfering in Latin American countries' internal affairs if it suited the interests of U.S. businesses. Starting with President Hoover, however, and continuing under Roosevelt, America began a good neighbor policy toward Central and South America. The policy basically pledged that America would maintain pleasant relations and generally mind its own business. America tried to keep to that policy elsewhere in the world as well. In Asia, Japan was becoming more and more hostile toward its neighbors, and U.S. diplomats made periodic attempts to convince Japan to slow down. But Japan had been insulted when America closed its doors to Japanese immigration in 1924 and wasn't in the mood to listen. And Americans weren't interested in a fight, even after Japan invaded China in 1931, or when Japanese planes accidentally sank a U.S. gunboat in a Chinese river in 1937. In Europe, Italy, run by a strutting thug, Benito Mussolini, invaded Ethiopia in 1936 with not much more than a whimper from the United States. When Germany, under an evil madman, Adolf Hitler, took Austria and Czechoslovakia in 1938, President Roosevelt sent letters asking the dictators not to conquer any more countries. They laughed at him. Remember, Roosevelt was not being timid as much as he was being a practical politician. America was still reeling from the effects of the Great Depression, and most Americans were more interested in figuring out how to pay next month's rent than who ran Austria. A 1937 survey found that 94% thought U.S. policy should be directed at keeping out of foreign wars rather than trying to stop them. An isolationist movement, whose most popular leader was aviator hero Charles Lindbergh, gained strength and held rallies around the country, exhorting Roosevelt and Congress to keep the United States sheltered from the growing storm clouds in Asia and Europe. Congress and FDR agreed, approving laws in 1935 and again in 1937 that prohibited the sale of American weapons to any warring nation. But much of the rest of the world continued to rush toward conflict. On September 1, 1939, Germany invaded Poland. Great Britain and France had signed a pact pledging to come to Poland's defense and declared war on Germany. World War II had begun. France was badly prepared for war and collapsed quickly under the German Blitzkrieg, or Lightning War. By mid-1940, England stood alone against Hitler and his allies, which, for the time being, included the Soviet Union, led by its own evil madman, Joseph Stalin. The Great Stone Faces. John Robinson had this idea for a sculpture, a big sculpture. Robinson was the state historian of South Dakota in the 1920s, and he thought it would be cool to turn a cliff in the state's Black Hills into a tribute to figures from the Old West, such as Buffalo Bill Cody. So he and other supporters of the idea hunted up an Idaho sculptor named John Guzman de la Mothe Borglum. Borglum liked the concept, but not the subject. In 1927, with the blessing of South Dakota, and eventually about $1 million from Congress, Borglum began using dynamite to blast away granite from the side of a mountain named after a New York lawyer named Charles Rushmore. Instead of Old West figures, however, Borglum carved the heads of four American presidents: George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, and Theodore Roosevelt. The job wasn't finished until October 1941, when Mount Rushmore National Memorial opened to the public. Borglum didn't live to see it. He died in March 1941, but his son, somewhat appropriately named Lincoln, carried on his work, and more than 2.7 million visitors view the mammoth effort every year. Very few ask, "Where's Buffalo Bill?" Sensing the unavoidable. Roosevelt, like most Americans, was still not eager for war. But unlike the ardent isolationists, he also figured it was inevitable and began to take steps to get ready for it in 1940 and 1941. They included authorizing the doubling of the size of the U.S. Navy, pledging to come to the aid of any North, Central, or South American country that was attacked, pushing Congress to approve the first peacetime military draft in U.S. history. The draft required all men between the ages of 21 and 35, about 16 million, to register. About 1.2 million were drafted for a year's service, and 800,000 reservists were called to active duty. In October 1941, Congress fortuitously voted to extend the draft, but it was a very close vote, 203 to 202. Trading 50 old U.S. Navy destroyers to England in return for leases on military bases on English possessions in the Caribbean. Pushing the Lend-Lease Act through Congress, which authorized FDR to sell, trade, lease, or just plain give military hardware to any country he thought would use it to further the security of the United States. Ordering the Navy to attack on sight German submarines that had been preying on ships off the East Coast. No bloodshed, I promise. And while I am talking to you mothers and fathers, I give you one more assurance. I have said this before, but I shall say it again, again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars. Franklin Roosevelt, a few days before being elected to a third term as president, November 1940. Remember, despite all the preparations, many Americans still refused to believe war was inevitable. Then, on a sleepy Sunday morning less than 3 weeks before Christmas 1941, a Japanese naval and air force launched a surprise attack on the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. More than 2,400 U.S. military men were killed, 150 planes were destroyed, and 8 battleships were sunk or badly damaged. December 7th, in Roosevelt's words, had become a day which will live in infamy. The Andrews Sisters. They didn't have great voices, and they weren't especially beautiful, but they sure struck a chord with Americans in the 1940s. Laverne, 1911 to 1967, Maxine, 1916 to 1995, and Patty, 1918 to 2013 Andrews, were born in Minneapolis and were performing three-part harmonies in vaudeville by the time they were in their teens. Their first big hit, a Yiddish tune called "Bei mir bist du schon," came out in 1937 and sold 350,000 copies in a month. Other hit records included "Beat Me Daddy, 8 to the Bar," "Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy," "Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree," "Rum and Coca-Cola," and "Don't Fence Me In." They sold more than 70 million records, sang with virtually every big star of the day, from Glenn Miller to Bing Crosby, and appeared in 17 films where they usually played themselves. But the sisters, who often quarreled and sometimes didn't speak to each other except on stage, were best known as America's wartime sweethearts because of their tireless travels to entertain U.S. troops, both in the United States and overseas. We never got tired of trying to bring a little smile and a little music to the boys, Maxine later recalled. They didn't have much else to smile about. Gearing up for war. Despite all the warnings, the United States wasn't completely prepared when war broke out. The Depression had wiped out many of the country's machine and tool industries. The military was woefully undersupplied, and many soldiers found themselves drilling with toy guns and wooden tanks. In a way, however, the Depression was a good preparation for what was to come. Americans had learned to scrimp and persevere, and having been pushed into a fight, they were eager to oblige. Getting industry and the economy in shape for World War II. Gearing up the industry needed to wage a global war on two fronts was handicapped by a lack of manpower. More than 15 million Americans eventually served in the military. Training and supplying them was a staggering challenge. It took more than 6,000 people to provide food, equipment, medical services, and transportation to 8,000 soldiers. Many raw materials, such as rubber, manila fiber, and oil, were in short supply. And while Roosevelt was a great leader, he was not a great administrator. Nevertheless, Americans rose to the occasion. When FDR called for the production of 50,000 planes in a year, it was thought to be ridiculous. By 1944, the country was producing 96,000 a year. Technology blossomed. When metals became scarce, plastics were developed to take their place. Copper was taken out of pennies and replaced with steel. Nickel was removed from nickels. War-inspired pragmatism even affected fashions. To save material, men's suits lost their pant cuffs and vests, and women painted their legs to take the place of nylons. Other sacrifices were made as well. Gasoline and tires were rationed, as were coffee, sugar, canned goods, butter, and shoes. But the war proved to be more of an economic inconvenience than a real trial for most people. Of course, all that military hardware had a hefty price tag. The federal government spent about $350 billion during World War II, or twice as much as it had spent in total for the entire history of the U.S. government up to that point. About 40% of that came from taxes. The rest came from government borrowing, much of that through the sale of bonds. All that money had to go someplace. A lot of it went to the West, especially California, where 10% of all the federal war spending took place. But the American economy rose just about everywhere else, too. The civilian workforce grew 20%. The gross national product, the total of goods and services produced, more than doubled between 1939 and 1945. Wages and corporate profits went up, as did prices. In October 1942, Congress gave the president the power to freeze agricultural prices, wages, salaries, and rents. The Roosevelt administration created the Office of Price Administration, OPA, to oversee prices and wages. But the OPA proved generally ineffective, and the economy mostly ran itself. Technical stuff. The statistics of war supplies. Production boomed during the war to the tune of the following figures. Aircraft, 296,429. Artillery, 372,431. Bullets, 41.59 million. Naval ships, 87,620. Tanks and self-propelled guns, 102,351. And trucks, 2.46 million. Working with labor unions during war times. The serious labor shortage created by the war was a big boost to union membership. Early on, FDR got labor to agree to a no-strike pledge and a 15% limit on wage increases. Even so, there were numerous work stoppages as the war wore on. The government actually seized the nation's coal mines in 1943 after a major strike, and also seized the railroads in late 1943 to avert a strike. Congress eventually passed a law requiring unions to wait 30 days before striking. Many perceived the strikes as slightly treasonous, and "there are no strikes in foxholes" became a popular response to labor stoppages. Still, as labor leaders pointed out, things were a lot better for a lot of working Americans. Average weekly wages went from $24 in 1939 to $46 in 1944. Da for the working Yank. To American production, without which this war would have been lost. Toast by Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, October 1943. Henry J. Kaiser. Henry Kaiser had never built a ship, so he didn't know he was doing it wrong. All he knew was that he was doing it fast and helping to win the war. Kaiser was born in New York, 1882. He left school at the age of 13 to go to work and eventually ended up on the West Coast as an engineer. During the Depression, he helped to build major dams in the West, such as Boulder and Grand Coulee, and when the war started, he was asked to help provide ships. He did it by using assembly line methods, building sections and then welding them together. Traditional shipbuilders were skeptical that it would work, but Kaiser's method streamlined the process of building a cargo vessel, called a Liberty Ship, from 245 days to 17. By 1943, Kaiser's shipyards were producing an average of 2 ships a day, helping to keep England fed, providing supplies for overseas troops, lowering enemy morale, and earning Kaiser the nickname Sir Launchalot. Kaiser's interests were by no means limited to ships. He also built magnesium and aluminum plants to provide parts for planes, and built the first steel-producing plant in the West. After the war, he made jeeps and got into health care. He died in 1967, having proven that you can't stop a Kaiser when he's on a roll. Employing women for the war effort. Millions of women entered the workforce to take the place of the men who were off to the military. By 1943, 17 million women filled a third of civilian jobs, 5 million of them in war factories. If you followed recipes exactly in making cakes, you can learn to load shells, proclaimed billboards recruiting women to the workplace. Some companies offered child care or provided meals to take home as incentives to lure women into the workplace. But women were still given the short end of the stick when it came to wages. In 1944, women got an average of $31.21 a week for working in war-related factories, while men doing the same jobs were paid $54.65. Making strides, African Americans achieved greater equality. Many African Americans had hoped their service in World War I would help bring them equality in post-war America. But they were wrong. So when World War II started, some black leaders were wary. "Our war is not against the Hitler in Europe," editorialized one black newspaper, "but against the Hitlers in America." Some black leaders demanded assurances that loyalty this time around would be rewarded with more decent treatment. In response, Roosevelt established the Fair Employment Practices Commission and charged it with investigating cases where African Americans were discriminated against in war industries. The commission enjoyed some success, but the real economic boost for blacks came from the labor shortage, which fueled the movement of many from the South to industrial cities in the North and West. Rose Monroe. It was a classic case of life imitates art, imitates life. Early on in World War II, the government started propaganda campaigns to help get women involved in the war effort. One such campaign was built around a poster of an attractive and well-muscled, bandana-wearing woman named Rosie the Riveter. There was even a popular song to go along with it. But Rosie was a fictional character, until actor Walter Pidgeon visited an aircraft plant in Ypsilanti, Michigan, to make a short film promoting war bonds. There, he met a young widow named Rose Monroe, who was riveting planes to support her family. Pidgeon signed her up to be in the film, and she became an inspiration for millions of women entering the workforce for the first time. Born in 1920 in Kentucky, Monroe went to work after her husband died in a car accident. After the war, Monroe drove a cab, owned a beauty shop, started a construction company, and earned a pilot's license. She died in 1997, still an inspiration to new generations of working women. Remember, about 700,000 African Americans also served in the military, and some strides in equality were made. Blacks were admitted into the Air Force and Marines for the first time. The Air Force enlisted some 600 black pilots, and the first African American general was appointed in the Army. Some military units were even integrated toward the end of the war, although it was more for practical reasons than to further civil rights. Even so, race relations remained mired in racism and distrust. Several cities had race riots, the worst of which was in Detroit in 1943, when 34 people died. Angry that the racism of Hitler was being fought against, while the racism at home was largely ignored, many African Americans began taking a more active role in asserting their legal rights. The ranks of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, swelled from 50,000 before the war to more than 400,000 at war's end. The Battle of Los Angeles. On February 2, 1942, less than 2 months after Pearl Harbor was attacked, U.S. Naval Intelligence in Southern California issued a warning that a Japanese attack might occur that night. Sure enough, in the wee hours of February 25th, radar picked up unidentified blips about 120 miles off the coast of Los Angeles. Then, planes were reported near Long Beach, and then four anti-aircraft batteries began firing at something over Santa Monica. Within minutes, other military guns opened fire. Confusion reigned over the next 3 hours as contradictory reports poured in. By the dawn's early light, Los Angeles residents saw the results of the attack. No downed enemy planes, no bomb damage, a few traffic accidents, and one man dead from a heart attack. Eventually, it was decided that it had been a false alarm, and the fuss had probably been caused by weather balloons, or UFOs, as some folks now insist. Whatever the cause, for a few hours, the fighting had come uncomfortably close to the home front. Returning for work after being kicked out, Latinos. In 1942, the U.S. and Mexican governments reached an agreement to allow Mexican workers, braceros, to enter the United States to help make up the manpower shortage. Thousands of Mexicans, some of whom had been thrown out of America during the Depression, entered the country, mostly to take agricultural jobs in the West. The sudden influx sometimes caused friction, particularly in California. In Los Angeles, tensions between outlandishly garbed Latino youths and sailors led to the Zoot Suit Riots of 1943. To avoid further trouble, city officials passed a law prohibiting the wearing of zoot suits in public. Treating the Japanese Americans poorly. By far the most shameful aspect of World War II on the home front was the treatment of Japanese residents. About 125,000 people of Japanese descent lived in the United States, 110,000 of them on the West Coast. 70,000, called Nisei, were born here. The rest, called Issei, were born in Japan and immigrated. In the wake of Pearl Harbor, many of both groups' neighbors began to view them with suspicion and even hatred. "A Jap's a Jap," said Lieutenant General John DeWitt, who was in command of the West Defense. "It makes no difference whether he is an American or not." Remember, in February 1942, Roosevelt ordered the forced evacuation of all Japanese residents from the West Coast, supposedly to lessen the potential for them to engage in seditious or traitorous acts. They were moved to bleak concentration camps in remote areas. Many lost virtually everything they owned: homes, farms, businesses, and even personal possessions. Despite their treatment, about 8,000 Nisei volunteered to serve in the military. One group, the Fightin' 442nd, was one of the most decorated combat units of the war. It wasn't until the 1980s and 1990s that the Nisei were compensated for some of what they lost. In the meantime, Roosevelt's action was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court as a justifiable hardship. "Hardships are a part of war," said Justice Hugo Black, "and war is an aggression of hardships." Winning cuisine. If an army travels on its stomach, the United States rode to victory in World War II on Spam. Yes, Spam, the ubiquitous canned meat product made from pork shoulder and ham. Invented in 1937 by the Hormel Foods Corporation, Spam hit its culinary stride when the war began, as a substitute for rationed beef. Because it didn't need refrigeration, it was ideal for feeding troops, and they ate more than 100 million pounds of it. Spam was also fodder for GI humor. "Meatloaf without basic training." "The ham that didn't pass its physical." "The reason war is hell." But Spam was a lifesaver for countries whose food supplies had been pinched by the war. Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev once stated that without Spam, the Russian army would have starved. And it fries up so much better than caviar. Dealing with the war in Europe. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, FDR met with English Prime Minister Winston Churchill to decide what the forces of the Allies should do against the Axis powers, Germany, Italy, and Japan. The most pressing threat, they decided, was Hitler's Germany. The German army seemed to be on the brink of defeating the Soviet army, its one-time ally. If the Russians fell, Germany could turn its full attention to Britain. Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin wanted the Allies to launch an invasion of German-held Europe as soon as possible, because Russia was being mauled by the Germans. But Churchill wanted to nibble at the edges of the German Empire while bombing Germany from the air. FDR went along with the Brits. Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin managed to put their sharp differences aside and generally cooperate. That proved to be a key ingredient in the Allies' ultimate success. The trio met several times during the war to plot strategy and negotiate about what the world would be like after the war. Meeting at Yalta. The most important of the meetings of FDR, Churchill, and Stalin actually came toward the end of the war at Yalta, a former palace on the Black Sea in the Soviet Union. Roosevelt came to Yalta hoping to establish groundwork for a practical and powerful United Nations to be formed after the war, and also to convince Russians to enter the war against Japan and help speed up the end of the conflict. Stalin eventually agreed, but at a price. In return, the Soviet dictator got the other two to agree to give the Soviets control over broad areas of Europe, and a promise that each of the major nations on the UN Security Council would have veto power over council decisions. As it turned out, the price Roosevelt paid was far too high for what he got in return. Winning one step at a time. One of the most immediate problems was dealing with the menace posed by German submarines, or U-boats, in the Atlantic. Traveling in packs, the sub sank 3 million tons of Allied shipping in the first half of 1942 alone. But the Allies worked out a system of convoys and developed better anti-sub tactics. Most importantly, they built far more cargo ships than the Germans could possibly sink. In the summer of 1942, Allied planes began bombing targets inside Germany. Eventually, the bombing would take a terrible toll. In 1943, more than 40,000 people were killed in the city of Hamburg, and in 1945, the city of Dresden was all but destroyed. In February 1943, U.S. forces in North Africa had their first significant confrontation with the German army. It did not go well. The Green American troops were driven back from the strategic Kasserine Pass in Tunisia. But under a new commander, Major General George S. Patton, the U.S. forces rallied and counterattacked. Combined with victories by the British and other allies, the effort drove German forces out of Africa. From Africa, the Allies invaded Sicily and then advanced into the Italian mainland. Mussolini was overthrown and eventually executed by his own people. But the German army poured troops into the country, and it took until the end of 1944 for Italy to be completely controlled. On the Eastern Front, meanwhile, the Russian army gradually had turned the tables on the invading Germans and begun pushing them back, despite enormous civilian and military losses. And in England, the Allies, under the leadership of U.S. General Dwight D. Eisenhower, were preparing the greatest invasion force the world had ever seen. Making the final push. On June 6, 1944, D-Day, the Allied forces swept ashore on the beaches of Normandy in France. It was an astonishing logistical feat. Some 175,000 men were landed on the first day, a number that swelled to 325,000 in the first week, and eventually to 2.5 million. They were delivered by 5,300 ships and supported by 50,000 vehicles and 11,000 planes. By August, the U.S. Third Army, under the brash and aggressive Patton, pushed deep into France and to the edge of Germany itself. A little more than a week before Christmas, 1944, however, the Germans launched a desperate counterattack. Known as the Battle of the Bulge, the surprise attack succeeded at first, costing the United States 77,000 casualties. But the Germans were low on men and supplies and could not sustain the attack. By late January 1945, the Allies were again on the offensive. Discovering the war's greatest crime. Remember, as Allied troops moved deeper into the heart of German-held territory, they began to make stomach-churning, heart-wrenching discoveries. Concentration camps holding what was left of millions of Jews and other undesirables that German leaders had ordered to be murdered as a final solution to cleansing Germany of all but the Aryan race. Hitler's final solution became known to the civilized world as the Holocaust and resulted in the murders of 6 million Jews and 4 million non-Jews, including gays, gypsies, and the mentally and physically handicapped. The Holocaust was not a complete secret to the Allies. Scores of Jewish organizations and refugee groups sought to bring attention to the horror going on within Nazi-occupied Europe, but finding a way to stop it was not viewed as big a priority as winning the war, and the enormity of the crimes was not fully understood or believed until the camps were discovered and their stories told by survivors. Late in the war, the Roosevelt administration established the War Refugee Board, which helped organize the rescue of some European Jews. And the United States was the first country to formally recognize the Jewish State of Israel in 1948. But stopping the Holocaust as it was happening was simply not at the forefront of the war effort. Nazi nitwits. Adolf Hitler had an itch to bring the war to America. So in mid-June 1942, German subs landed 4 men on Long Island, New York, and 4 more on a Florida beach. They also landed cases of explosives. All the men had lived in America and spoke fluent English. Their mission was to sabotage U.S. factories, incite terror, and disrupt the economy. But they turned out to be an octet of oafs. Several of them went on shopping sprees. Several blabbed about their mission to relatives, and 2 of them blabbed to federal agents. Within 2 weeks of their arrival, all of them had been arrested by the FBI. After a military trial, all 8 were convicted of espionage. 6 of the Germans were executed, while the 2 who confessed were imprisoned for the rest of the war and then deported. Hitler's itch was never scratched. Not a single case of enemy-directed sabotage was ever verified during the war. Ending the war in Europe and the end of FDR. In April, the U.S. and Russian armies joined up at the Elbe River and advanced on Berlin. Hitler committed suicide, and on May 7th, VE, or Victory in Europe Day, Germany surrendered. Remember, Roosevelt did not live to see the victory. The president had won a 4th term in 1944, despite rumors about his failing health. But on April 12, 1945, while vacationing at Warm Springs, Georgia, FDR died suddenly of a cerebral hemorrhage. The nation was staggered at the loss of the man who had led them through the Depression and the war. One New York housewife was asked if she heard the radio bulletins of FDR's death and replied, "For what do I need a radio? It's on everybody's face." The new president, a former hat salesman from Missouri named Harry S. Truman, was as stunned as anyone. "Being president is like riding a tiger," Truman later wrote. "I never felt that I could let go for a single moment." That's a negative. Nuts. Reply of U.S. General Anthony McAuliffe to a German demand for surrender at Bastogne, Belgium, during the Battle of the Bulge. McAuliffe's troops held on until relieved. Dealing with the war in the Pacific. Less than 12 hours after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the Japanese attacked U.S. air bases in the Philippines, destroying scores of U.S. planes. Within a few months, they conquered Guam, Wake Island, Hong Kong, Singapore, the Dutch East Indies, Burma, and the Philippines. Drunk with victories, Japanese forces continued to expand their dominance in the Pacific during the first few months of the war. About the only good news for the Allies came on April 18, 1942, when a squadron of B-25 bombers launched from an aircraft carrier and led by Colonel James Doolittle managed to bomb Tokyo. The planes did little damage, and none of the planes made it back, with most of the crews having to ditch them in China. Still, Doolittle's raid was a huge shot in the arm for sagging American morale. Fighting back. U.S. strategists decided to strike back on 2 fronts. The first, under General Douglas MacArthur, would move north from Australia, through New Guinea, and then back to the Philippines. The second, under Admiral Chester Nimitz, would move west from Hawaii and then hopscotch from island to island toward Japan itself. But first, the Japanese offense had to be stopped. The initial halt came in early May 1942 at the Battle of the Coral Sea, northeast of Australia. It was the first naval fight in history where the fighting ships never actually saw each other. All the combat was done by planes from each side's aircraft carriers. The battle was pretty much a draw, but the Japanese fleet carrying invasion troops to New Guinea had to turn back, marking the first time the Japanese had not won outright. Turning the tide. Remember, the real turning point, however, came between June 3rd and June 6th in a fierce naval battle near the U.S.-held Midway Island. tipped the Japanese plans by intercepting their messages and breaking their codes, U.S. forces managed to sink four Japanese aircraft carriers, losing only one. The victory stopped the Japanese advance in the Central Pacific. A few months after the Battle of Midway, the United States took the offensive in the Solomon Islands, winning battles at Gavutu, Tulagi, and Guadalcanal. It took 6 grueling months to take Guadalcanal, but by mid-1943, the Japanese forces were either retreating or on defense nearly everywhere. Now it was America's turn. In February 1944, forces under Nimitz won victories in the Marshall Islands, and in the fall, Allied forces reopened supply lines in Southeast Asia into China. In mid-1944, a U.S. armada struck the Marianas Islands of Tinian, Guam, and Saipan, and on October 20, 1944, MacArthur made good on an earlier promise and returned to the Philippines. As the Germans did at the Battle of the Bulge, the Japanese threw everything they had into a counteroffensive. And, like the Germans, they lost. The Battle of Leyte Gulf cost Japan 4 more carriers and all but ended its ability to mount an offensive. Next came the battle for the island of Okinawa, just 370 miles south of Japan itself. The Japanese sent suicide planes called kamikazes, divine wind, on one-way trips into U.S. ships, and while they were horrifyingly effective, they weren't enough. After 50,000 Allied and 100,000 Japanese were killed or wounded, Okinawa fell in late June 1945. U.S. submarines were taking a huge toll on Japanese supply lines, sinking more than half of all the enemy's cargo ships by the end of the war. American planes, meanwhile, had been softening the Japanese mainland. In May 1945, they dropped napalm on Tokyo, killing 80,000 people. The bombings were designed to make the eventual invasion of Japan easier. Even so, U.S. strategists figured it would take more than a year of fighting and more than 1 million American soldiers would be killed or wounded before the Japanese homeland would fall. What the strategists did not count on was a terrible new weapon that had been conceived in New York and Tennessee and spawned on a New Mexico desert. Audie Murphy. He was a pint-sized Texas orphan who joined the Army as a buck private at the age of 16. When he came home, he weighed a lot more, mostly because of the medals on his chest. Murphy was born in 1926 to poor sharecropper parents. After joining the Army, Murphy saw action in 9 major campaigns in North Africa, Italy, and France, single-handedly killing more than 200 enemy soldiers while rising to the rank of second lieutenant. On January 26, 1945, in France, Murphy took on an attack by 6 German tanks and supporting infantry. Despite being wounded, he fought until he ran out of ammunition, which was long enough to direct artillery fire and beat back the German attack. His heroism won Murphy more than 30 citations, including the Congressional Medal of Honor and the French Croix de Guerre. After the war, America's most decorated soldier became a movie actor, making 44 films. One of them, To Hell and Back, was based on his own best-selling autobiography. Murphy died in a plane crash in 1971 at the age of 45. Dropping the bomb. Even before the war began, scientists fleeing from Nazi Germany had warned U.S. officials the Germans were working on developing a huge new bomb that would be triggered through an atomic reaction. An alarmed U.S. government began pouring what would amount to more than $2 billion into the Manhattan Project, so-called because it started in New York. Work continued at top-secret bases in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Los Alamos, New Mexico, under the direction of physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer. The project was so hush-hush that Vice President Harry Truman wasn't told of it until he assumed the presidency after FDR's death. On July 16, 1945, the world's first atomic bomb was detonated at a testing ground in New Mexico. "It works," muttered an awestruck Oppenheimer, who later said it made him recall a line from Hindu scripture, "I am become death, the shatterer of worlds." On July 26, 1945, Allied leaders delivered a surrender ultimatum to Japan, but it was rejected by Japanese military leaders. On August 6, 1945, a single B-29 bomber, nicknamed Enola Gay, dropped an atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima. The bomb killed 75,000 people and injured another 100,000 in the city of 340,000. Thousands more eventually died from the radiation. Remember, debate has raged ever since as to whether Japan would have surrendered if the bomb had not been dropped. But at the time, there was little hesitation about its use on the part of the man who made the decision. President Truman was convinced that bomb's use was an acceptable alternative to the horrific carnage of a U.S. invasion of Japan. "I regarded the bomb as a military weapon," he said later, "and never had any doubt that it should be used." Japan was stunned by the destruction of the Hiroshima bomb, but its leaders hesitated in surrendering. 3 days later, another bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. The next day, Japan surrendered. The final ceremony took place on September 2nd aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. World War II, the bloodiest and most devastating war in human history, was over. About 30 million civilians and military personnel around the world had been killed. American losses, compared to the other major combatant countries, had been light. About 300,000 were killed, and another 750,000 were injured or wounded. But while the war was over, a new age that included the threat of even more horrible wars was just beginning. Part 4. America in Adulthood. In this part, see how America emerges as a world power after World War II and engages in a Cold War with the USSR. Learn about one president's assassination and another's resignation. Understand how America loses a war and moves slowly toward righting. Blush at a U.S. president's sex scandal and impeachment, and watch the country move with cautious confidence toward a new millennium. Chapter 17. TV, Elvis, and Reds Under the Bed, 1946 to 1960. In this chapter, cooling down relations with Russia and heating things up in Korea, testing Americans' loyalty, letting the good times roll and rock, working against segregation. If you had asked most Americans in 1945 how they felt about the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, USSR, they probably would have responded with warm and fuzzy statements about their brave ally against Hitler. Had you asked them in 1950, however, you would have received a very different answer. In this chapter, Americans combat communism at home and abroad, real and imagined. They move to the suburbs, eat in their cars, and discover a new medium religion called television. They also embrace a form of music with its roots in African-American culture, but are much less willing to embrace African-Americans themselves. A Cold War and a Hot Police Action. The foundations of the Cold War were broader than just the ideological struggle between capitalism and communism. The Soviet Union had suffered terribly during World War II and was hungry to recover. Soviet leaders feared and distrusted the United States, which was the only country with the atomic bomb, and which had used it. They were also determined to surround the Soviet Union with countries that would not be a threat to it in future wars. America saw its former ally as a nation led by men who were as duplicitous and dangerous as those the Allies had just defeated. The Soviets' desire to forcibly impose itself on other countries was unacceptable. Heavy drapes. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Winston Churchill, referring to the spread of Soviet influence across Europe in a March 5, 1946 speech in Fulton, Missouri. Joining the United Nations. After World War I, the U.S. Senate voted against joining the League of Nations. The second time around, however, it jumped at the chance to join the League's successor. On July 28, 1945, senators voted 89-2 in favor of joining the United Nations, UN, which had its first meeting in 1946 in London and then moved to its permanent home in New York City.